WRCT Pittsburgh.
WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM, rocks.
All right, I want to start with a correction today. I always strive for accuracy and precision and so on. Yesterday, in my discussion of the emails I had gotten about Kyle Rittenhouse's mom, Wendy Rittenhouse, some people saying, David, she's clearly cognitively disabled or delayed or whatever term you want to apply. I mentioned, in among many other things, that she's a nurse and has a certain level of education. She's not a nurse. She's a clinical, a certified nursing assistant, a CNA. And is it clinical or certified? A CNA. It is not a nurse. So whatever inferences you, me, or anybody else makes, let's make them based on just the actual information. She's a CNA, not a nurse. Doesn't necessarily change my analysis. Okay, let's get on to the news. We have seen now the signing into law of the $1.2 trillion infrastructure bill that we discussed last week. Again, for context, this was a very big bill that became smaller and smaller and smaller, down to $1.2 trillion, with only $550 billion of the $1.2 trillion actually being new spending for new projects, which we will talk about in a moment. Big signing ceremony on the White House lawn. Joe Biden could have signed it earlier, but he wanted to do a White House lawn event with a bipartisan group of elected officials because, yes, remember, there were some Republicans who voted for this bill, much to the chagrin of the Trump Republicans, who immediately started saying, let's get rid of all of those Republicans who crossed party lines to vote in favor of the infrastructure bill. They had a brass band. They had speeches. The Associated Press called them peppy speeches, and Joe Biden signed the bill into law. Now we're going to go over the final version of what's in the bill. But the big picture here is that this entire escapade is a humiliation. And what I mean by that is the stuff we're spending money on in this infrastructure bill should be obvious. We all agree. We just do this stuff. We're a wealthy, developed nation. We have the money. We do this stuff. That's what it should be. And instead, it becomes months and months of debate and argument and disagreement and shrinkage of this package. Extreme shrinkage, I would even say. And this is ultimately what we end up with. OK, so what's in the bill now that it has finally been passed? $1.2 trillion, $550 billion is actually for new projects. That includes $110 billion for roads and bridges, desperately needed. $66 billion for railroads. Our railroad system is pathetic. Now, I know many people will say, David, sir, we are not a small European country that can easily be connected with rail. You know, New York State is the size of some European countries. We're talking about a massive country. Fine. Eastern Seaboard, Western Seaboard, northeast to Chicago area. So many opportunities for faster, modern rail. We don't have it. It's pathetic. $65 million for the power grid. Desperately needed. $65 billion for broadband. Now, the broadband thing, it's a little bit frustrating that we already give breaks and subsidies and all of these things to these internet service providers, and we still have such crappy broadband in many parts of the country. And one of the things I like is that the incoming FCC chair wants to define broadband as 100 megabit up and 100 megabit down, asymmetrical. We have had this issue time and time again at our backup studio, which I've mentioned that we have. I have options. I can get 100 megabit download, 250 megabit download, 500. I can get gigabit download. And I say, OK, but we need to upload big files. What's the fastest upload I can get? Well, sir, if you pay $200 a month, you can get a 35 megabit upload. It's pathetic. It's pathetic. So on broadband, we're failing. There's $65 billion in the bill. How much more money are we going to give these ISPs before they actually put together something approximating what other countries consider to be high-speed internet? $55 billion for water infrastructure. We still have parts of this country where you shouldn't really be drinking the tap water. It's horrifying. $47 billion for cybersecurity and climate change. $39 billion for public transit. $25 billion for airports. We've talked about the sort of sad state of many American airports, particularly not even just compared to other wealthy countries, but even some not so wealthy countries that have invested in airports. $21 billion for the environment. And at some point, we'll dig in more as to what that means. $17 billion for ports. $11 billion for safety. $8 billion for Western water infrastructure. $7.5 billion for electric vehicle charging stations. We've got to build that out, guys. And $7.5 billion for electric school buses. Funding will go out over a 5-year period. And it, of course, as you probably would guess, it can take months, if not years, to start certain projects. A lot of this stuff, you know, one of the frustrating things is that you have criticisms from the American right, which can be resolved by this type of spending, but they also don't want the spending. I'll give you one example here. They complain about high gas prices. Well, let's get off gas. Let's go to electric vehicles. They also don't want to subsidize electric vehicles. They just want to blame Joe Biden. That's fundamentally sort of what it comes down to at the end of the day. They say that we need to deal with the power outages that we have in different places. Well, they also don't want to spend money reinforcing the power grid in the context of climate change because they say it's politicizing power. And it's a, guys, we know how to fix a lot of these problems, but they just want to complain about the problems rather than actually fix them. Okay, so is this a win? Yes, it's a win. It's a win. But to what extent is it a win? The package shrinking down to $1.2 trillion. Only $550 billion is new spending. The rest of it is just funding projects that are already that already exist. Not super exciting. The next step is that Joe Biden is going to spend much of this week making the case for that second bill. Some people call it the Build Back Better bill. Some are saying it's dead on arrival, that there's no chance. But there's now another bill Joe Biden wants to pass, $1.75 trillion. Social safety net investment, climate policy investment. If you could do all of that, now we're really talking about a more serious accomplishment. The House hopes to pass its version of the bill sometime this week. If that happens, then there will be a question of, is there any way to pass such a bill in the Senate? It's really unclear. It would certainly become a serious accomplishment if that were the case. And Joe Biden's going to be in New Hampshire, Michigan, and some other places selling the infrastructure plan this week. So if he can get that done, in particular before the new year, although I'm very, very skeptical about that, we would really be talking about a more serious accomplishment. But that's what's in the bill. And of course, implementation. Anybody can sign bills. The key is in the implementation, and we're going to follow it. You know, one of the most troubling aspects of this cult that is the American right wing in the United States is the degree to which they abandon even their stated principles that they claim to hold above all else as soon as it's not convenient for them to stick to the principle. If I say to you which side talks about being the constitutional side as a matter of pride, it's the American right. They say we are about the Constitution. We are about the rule of law. We are about having a country that is the image that our founders envisioned and demanded and imagined and created this girl, blah, 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 all that stuff. Okay. But they abandon it very quickly. One of the most important aspects on which the United States was founded, and really it's why did they leave the old country and come here, is freedom of religion, which includes freedom from religion as well, but freedom of religion, whatever religion you want to practice. Donald Trump's former national security advisor, the top national security official in the country for a period of time, if you can believe it, as scary as that is, recently said at an event called the Reawaken America Conference in San Antonio, Texas. Completely insane event. He said, listen, we not only, if we're going to be one nation under God, we need to be one religion under God. What happened to the Constitution? Listen to Michael Flynn, who appears to have completely lost his mind if he ever had it.
And they're talking about the United States of America.
Right.
Talking about the United States of America, because when Matthew mentioned it in the Bible, he wasn't talking about the physical ground that he was on. He was talking about something in the distance. So if we are going to have one nation under God, which we must, we have to have one religion, one nation under God and one religion under God, right? All of us together working.
What? What? Has he seen the Constitution? Is he aware of the document which supposedly he and his ilk hold above all else, almost like a sacred text? We have to be one religion under God. What are you talking about? And Flynn has recently been really upping the Christian rhetoric significantly. And part of this may be related to there are some QAnon people who think Michael Flynn worships Satan. And in order to convince crazy people that he's not a Satan worshiper, he's really playing up the Christian dogma. And it's leading to him being particularly unhinged lately. And remember, this was the top national security official of the United States at one point in time. At this same event, he also had very wacky things to say about Nancy Pelosi. And he's just like off the rails with very weird religious stuff. Take a listen to this.
And that's a great song. If you listen to the words, it really does. It talks about we're not going to take it anymore. The American people are not going to take it. I literally, and I'll probably, I hope that they run the hit tonight, because I just did a media hit with Tucker Carlson for his show this evening.
Crowd likes Tucker.
And my message, we talked about, you know, this nonsense going on with what I call the insurrection, crucifixion, and Nancy Pelosi is the Pontius Pilate. She's the
Pontius Pilate.
Pontius Pilate. And this is a crucifixion of our First Amendment, freedom to speak, freedom to peaceably assemble. I mean, it's unbelievable. It's unbelievable. In fact, it's been over 40 years, we've never had one person, not one person, held in contempt or indicted for contempt of Congress in over 40 years, to include a former Attorney General of the United States by the name of Eric Holder. And, of course, today, if you saw, if you're watching the media.
Okay, so as you can tell, completely unhinged. Like, how is there not an investigation going on into Michael Flynn? And remember that he was indicted and then pardoned by Donald Trump. And also remember that shortly after being pardoned, he called for a straight up coup like in Myanmar, which in this bizarre clip from the Forgotten Country event was referred to as Myanmar by a guy on stage. Remember this crazy incident?
I'm a simple Marine. I want to know why what happened in Myanmar can't happen here.
No reason. I mean, it should happen here. No reason. But that's right.
So there's Michael Flynn saying there's no reason why we shouldn't have a coup just like they did in Myanmar, which, of course, is Myanmar. The guy who mentioned it has no idea what's going on. So extremely disturbing behavior for Michael Flynn, and probably someone that should be on the radar of law enforcement. But he seems to really have lost his mind. We're going to take a quick break. We have such a packed show for you today. Let me know what's on your mind. You can follow me on Twitter at @dpackman, and we will be right back. Remember that the David Pakman Show is primarily funded by viewers and listeners like you. We have a membership program on our website. We include an extra show every single day for our paid subscribers. And we offer commercial-free audio and video feeds of The Daily Show for our members. We give priority access during our viewer town halls, the next which will be in a couple of weeks. Haven't finalized the date, but I will let you know very, very soon. There's the members-only newsletter and so many other great things. Sign up at joinpacman.com. You can use the coupon code FELONY21 to get a discount. It's such a big discount. It should be a felony, but it's not. And you can sign up at joinpacman.com. So we've been having a conversation now for, what, a year, close to a year, a little longer, about the partisan uptake of the COVID vaccines. And one of the most anti-vaccine groups today with regard to the COVID vaccines is Republicans, and in particular, Trump voters. Non-Trump voting Republicans are slightly less anti-vax than Trump voting Republicans, who are like the most anti-vax. And we know why this has happened. We know about the way that their view on the vaccines has reversed simply because Donald Trump is no longer in office and now Joe Biden is. And we've talked also about the increasingly partisan COVID deaths, where much more now by an almost 50% higher rate, the cumulative COVID death rate in Trump counties is higher than in Biden voting counties. They're killing themselves at a disproportionately high rate relative to Democrats. And at some point, it may make an electoral difference. But we now have new data, and this is going beyond just the COVID vaccine. The acceptance of the flu vaccine, as we now are getting into and into flu season in the United States, is also heavily partisan, and it didn't used to be. You used to see almost identical levels of flu vaccination from Democrats as you saw from Republicans. No more. We have the data, and the data is quite detailed. Flu shot uptake is now partisan, and it didn't used to be. So we have two polls from flu shot uptake right now. OK, according to Ipsos, 68% of Democrats said they have gotten a flu shot or are very likely to get one, whereas only 44% of Republicans said the same. So that's a 24-point gap between Democrats and Republicans on the flu shot, similar to the COVID gap that exists. A second poll from this year shows the same thing. 65% of Democrats said they did or will definitely get a flu shot, and only 40% of Republicans. That's a 25-point partisan gap on the flu shot. That's not the way it always used to be. For example, last year there was an AP NORC poll, and it said, did you get a flu shot in the last year? In that poll, 58% of Democrats said, I got a flu shot in the last year, whereas only 54% of Republicans did. That was a 4-point gap. It's almost the margin of error. OK, so you used to have almost even flu shot acceptance between Republicans and Democrats. Now you have a gap where by 24, 25 points, Democrats are significantly more vaccinated against the flu as are Republicans. Another just data point about past partisan gap. If you look at a 2016 study from Princeton Survey Research, you had 55% of Democrats and 53% of Republicans saying, I got a flu shot in the last 12 months. So there was almost no partisan gap whatsoever. So in all seriousness, are Republicans hurting themselves electorally because of this? If they just keep dying, it at some point is going to start impacting your population. So let's talk about what's not new. Science has had a partisan divide for a long time. So take the issue of climate change. For decades now, the right has disproportionately rejected the science on climate, including the reality that humans are impacting changing climate on planet Earth. Republicans have rejected that. Now, the thing about climate is, it mostly affects everybody, regardless of partisanship. Now, you can make the case, well, the more we burn fossil fuels, poor people disproportionately are downwind from the emissions from burning fossil fuels. So it's causing more cancer in poor people. And to the extent that there's a partisan divide there, maybe. OK, so you can make a case. This is just straight up partisan with the vaccines. The Republicans are disproportionately not getting vaccinated against COVID. The Republicans are now also, as of this year, disproportionately not getting vaccinated against the flu. At a certain point, you're going to kill your own voters and it could make a difference. Now, we've looked at the data. What would it take to make a difference? There was this example, and I'll talk through the generalities of it, but we should really look at the data again. Back in, let me see when it was, Florida gubernatorial election results. When Ron DeSantis ran in 2018, Ron DeSantis won by 0.4% over Andrew Gillum. I forget the pronunciation now. It was a difference of 33,000 votes. 33,000 votes were the margin for Ron DeSantis in Florida as governor in the year 2018. Now, in Florida, there are 61,000 COVID deaths that we know of, and there are very serious questions about the degree to which Florida is coming even close to reporting all the deaths from COVID. So if there's 60,000, there's probably really at least 70,000. Let's pick that number. If they were evenly split between Democrats and Republicans, 70,000 COVID deaths would mean 35,000 Democrats and 35,000 Republicans. Now, if you have a partisan gap there, if you imagine, well, if the Florida data tracks the national data and Republicans are dying at, let's call it a 50% higher rate, all of a sudden those 70,000 deaths might look more like 50,000 Republicans and 20,000 Democrats. That's a 30,000 death gap. The margin for victory for DeSantis was only about 33,000 ballots in 2018. So you can very quickly see how if this continues to go on, and the partisan gap is there on COVID deaths because of vaccination, and we start to see a partisan gap on flu deaths again, because Republicans are now starting to reject the flu vaccine as well. In Florida, it's totally plausible that as a result of deaths from COVID and flu alone, it could flip an election from a Republican governor to a Democratic governor. OK, those are the numbers in Florida. We'd have to see where else this applies. This is a reality, and I'm not giving Republicans advice. If they're not worried about this and they're not realizing how quickly the numbers could go against them here, it's their problem. But you would think even if they don't care about the human tragedy of these deaths, that they would care about the electoral consequences that potentially could happen. So that's the latest on flu shot, and we're going to continue watching how those numbers look. The latest thing now on COVID vaccines is that there are people trying to undo their vaccination or reverse the vaccination, almost as if you were poisoned and you want the antidote, the antidote. Now, of course, this is all bogus nonsense BS, but it's quite stunning. And I want to talk about it a little bit. Look at this. COVID vaccine holdouts are caving to mandates and then scrambling to undo their shots. So there are people who they don't want to lose a job, or they want to be able to go to wherever it is anti-vaccine people like to go. And so they're acquiescing and getting vaccinated, but then they are reversing their vaccine. How are they doing that? Well, it doesn't work. Check this out. This is a very good NBC News article by Ben Collins. In a TikTok video that has garnered hundreds of thousands of views, Dr. Carrie Medej outlined the ingredients for a bath she said will detox the vax for people who gave in and got vaccinated. The ingredients in the bath are mostly not harmful, although the supposed benefits are entirely fictional. Baking soda and Epsom salts, she falsely claims, will provide a radiation detox to remove radiation Medej falsely believes is activated by the vaccine. There's about four different things there that we could look at. Bentonite clay will add a, quote, major pull of poison, she says, based on a mistaken idea in anti-vax communities that toxins can be removed from the body with certain therapies. Then she recommends adding in a cup of borax, a cleaning agent that's been banned as a food additive by the FDA, to, quote, take nanotechnologies out of you. In reality, in addition to being potentially harmful as a skin and eye irritant, a borax detox bath will not remove the effects of the COVID vaccine from your body. So it's baking soda, Epsom salt, bentonite clay, and borax. I suggest adding in cocoa powder and whole wheat flour. Bake it for 20 minutes and you'll have some really, really nice muffins at the end of the day. OK, the video is one of several methods anti-vax influencers have suggested to followers. Anti-vax message boards are now littered with users caving to societal pressure or work mandates. Once you're injected, the life-saving vaccination process has already begun. You can't unring a bell. It's just not physically possible, says Angela Rasmussen, a virologist and professor at University of Saskatchewan in Canada. Detox remedies and regimens have been staples of the anti-vax movement for years. Before COVID, anti-vax influencers and alternative health entrepreneurs promoted unproven, sometimes dangerous treatments they claimed would rid children of alleged toxins that lingered after immunization. Children, many with autism, have been subjected to these disproven cures by way of parents convinced that they're alleviating suffering caused by heavy metal poisoning from vaccines. The often costly remedies have included restrictive diets, supplements, chelation, and hyperbaric chambers, as well as dangerous home remedies. And there's more. Now, some anti-vax groups recommend people who have been vaccinated immediately self-administer cupping therapy to speed up the removal of vax content, including first making small incisions on the injection site with a razor. Other memes give instructions on how to uninject shots using syringes. Both methods are potentially dangerous and wouldn't actually do what they claim to do. This is crazy. This is straight up crazy. I saw a tweet from cultural critic, the last real liberal and arbiter of ideas, Dave Rubin, where he tweeted, quote, "I know a lot of people who regret getting the vaccine. Don't know anyone who regrets not getting it. The people who regret getting the vaccine seem very confused, and they seem to believe things that are bogus. The people who regret not getting the vaccine, many of them are dead." And as I tweeted myself in response to Dave Rubin, lots of the people who regretted not getting the vaccine have since died of COVID. We heard about a number of radio hosts who were against vaccines, got very sick with COVID, hospitalized, and said, "I was wrong about the vaccine. Get the vaccine." And then they died. It's actually more sad than anything else that this is going on. And I continue to believe that if at age 10, 11, we start teaching kids, here's how you examine whether your beliefs are justified by facts. Here's how you critically analyze messages that you get in media, called media literacy, philosophy, etc. A lot of people would be immunized, for lack of a better term, against ever falling for all of this bogus backwards thinking. Unfortunately, we have a lot of people on the right who don't want to teach those things because they rightly see them as threats to right-wing ideology. The better critical thinkers people are, the more media literate people are, the better at understanding the concepts of epistemology students are. It's true, they're less likely to fall for easily debunkable right-wing talking points, and that's what scares them so much. We'll have more on this on our Instagram. Follow us on Instagram at David Pakman Show. Today, I'm going to be speaking with Amanda Montell, who's a linguist, also author of the book Cultish, The Language of Fanaticism, and co-host of the podcast Sounds Like a Cult. Amanda, great having you on. I really appreciate your time.
Thank you so much for having me.
So we've talked with cult experts sort of in the context of whether some of the followers of former President Trump are a cult. We've talked with cult experts about sort of like what pulls people into cults and how can you get people out of cults and the concept of like a deprogramming. And one of the things that always happens when we talk about it is I get emails from people saying, only certain people are susceptible to cults. It would never happen to me, which may be true, but there's this idea that there's something specific and some people, just like they can't be hypnotized, they would never be susceptible to a cult. Is that true? Is there something about the types of people that would even fall prey to cults?
Sure. Well, I was absolutely one of those people who thought I would never fall prey to a cult. I grew up with a cult survivor in the family. My dad was forced to join a cult called Synanon when he was a teenager. Mm-hmm. My parents are research scientists. I grew up in a home of skepticism and independent thinking. I thought never would I join a fanatical fringe group or fall prey to the charms of a charismatic guru. But then very quickly after researching this book, I found that the mythology surrounding the type of person who would join a cult, a word that really has no hard and fast past definition. Those stereotypes aren't exactly true. We tend to think of the sort of person who'd wind up in a cult like Heaven's Gate or the People's Temple, aka Jonestown, as someone desperate and disturbed, intellectually deficient. But first of all, why would a cult want someone like that? Why would they want someone who's liable to break down quickly? They want someone with an overabundance of idealism and with resources and privileges and connections and stars in their eyes, someone who believes that solutions to the world's most urgent problems are able to be found, and by affiliating with this group that they can be a part of that change. They want people who aren't going to quit after things invariably turn sour quite soon. So the cult survivors that I spoke to, survivors of everything from Jonestown to SoulCycle, they didn't fit this mold of the desperate cult follower. They were actually quite wise and service-oriented.
You mentioned SoulCycle, which I think is interesting. Are cults necessarily bad in the sense of, I mean, some people might say like the Peloton world is sort of cultish, CrossFit right. is another one, SoulCycle, et cetera. Are cults necessarily bad?
Sure. Well, this is why I decided to title the book Cultish, and it's why I often hedge my language when I talk about this wide spectrum of culty, cult-like, cultish groups.
Yeah.
Our reputation that, or the reputation that cults have as inherently sinister and nefarious is in large part shaped by the media coverage of major cult tragedies like Jonestown and the Manson family murders. Before those events, the word cult was not really on the mainstream cultural radar. And in fact, the earliest forms of this word didn't even have really negative meanings at all. The word evolved over time, exactly line in line with how our culture evolved. So at this point, the word cult can really be used, depending on the context, to refer to everything from a group as deadly and destructive as QAnon to a widely followed wellness brand or SoulCycle. And that really reflects something about how fraught our culture's relationship is with ideas of community and spirituality and identity and meaning. But the definition of the word cult has so much to do with cultural normativity, what separates a cult from a religion, from another kind of socially accepted group.
Right.
Not all cults that have been called cults or could be called cults are inherently criminal or dangerous. So the word cult isn't really enough to identify what particular dangers are on the table.
Yeah, I mean, I think it might be interesting to hear a little more about evaluating maybe the parameters. You know, thinking back to the 2020 Democratic primary, I commented on there seems to be kind of a cult-ish thing happening around Andrew Yang, for example, who I like and is going to be on this show next week. I was a supporter of Bernie Sanders, but there mm-hmm. was some cultishness if you looked on Reddit and Twitter around Bernie, certainly around this candidate named Tulsi Gabbard, who you may or may not be familiar with. What are the parameters we should sort of be looking at?
Sure. Well, in some contexts, certainly in this one, I don't find that it's always useful to strive to identify, oh, this is definitively a cult,
yeah.
and thus it is wildly dangerous. But
right.
yes, it's good to be aware of certain red flags, if you will, that can signify that something is cultish. And in the book, I outline what these red flags sound like rather than what they look like. You know, cult imagery often involves shaved heads and long robes, and sometimes a cult is actually a bunch of people in t-shirts or leggings, or, you know, it doesn't look like the cult we've been conditioned to see. So I outline many of these linguistic red flags in the book, and these can include super emotionally charged us versus them labels, when everybody inside the group is uplifted with terminology that love bombs them, if you will, that makes them feel special and elite, while there are these, you know, super loaded terms that lambast everybody on the outside as fundamentally inferior in a super black and white way. Even just the creation of a ton of specialized terminology can be a sign that something cultish is going on here. We all love the feeling of speaking a secret language. You know, like pig Latin on the playground. Who didn't love learning that and being able to talk in a way that other kids couldn't understand? It makes us feel like we're putting on a uniform, if you will, like we're doing something right, even if we're not not saying anything that can't be said in plain English, even if we don't ourselves understand what we're saying exactly or couldn't define it for an outsider, that specialized terminology encourages conformity. It, in some cases, discourages independent thinking. And then there's this phrase that once you understand it, you won't be able to unhear it, that is often used in cultish groups. It's called a thought-terminating cliche. It's a linguistic technique that all cultish leaders from Jim Jones to Jeff Bezos use, and it describes a sort of stock expression that's easily memorized, easily repeated, and aimed at shutting down independent thinking or questioning. So thought-terminating cliches also show up in our everyday lives in the form of things like, well, it is what it is, or it's all in God's plan, boys will be boys. In QAnon, it might sound like, trust the plan, or, well, I did my research. Of course, research to a QAnoner doesn't involve peer-reviewed studies, but those are some examples.
As I'm hearing you lay this out, my mind just can't get away from Jordan Peterson. And I'm curious about another aspect, which is whenever I've made criticisms of Jordan Peterson in the past, a lot of the emails I get are, I am not accurately criticizing what he really is saying. I'm only criticizing what I wrongly believe him to be saying, and that there really is no true criticism because what he's saying is different than what I'm saying, which is sort of indefeasible. Like if you're always going to tell me I'm misunderstanding what he's saying, but you're actually saying sometimes the difficulty of understanding what's being said is a feature and not a bug.
Right. Absolutely. To use sort of circular language, misleading euphemisms, that can be really disorienting. I would venture to think that some of his followers are confused some of the time, but they just have this sort of unquestioned worshiping of him. And yeah, that completely sounds like a form of a thought-terminating cliche. It sounds not unlike when New Agers or Keith Raniere, if those were familiar with Nexium, would dismiss a valid doubt or concern as a limiting belief. Oh, that's just your mind limiting you from being able to understand.
Yeah, or that's a suppressive thought from the Church of Scientology, or
exactly.
There's a lot of analogies to that. So
in
the world of changing people's minds, there's this idea that just giving people facts doesn't get them to change their minds. It often kind of makes them plant their feet in the sand or dig their head in the sand, whatever metaphor or analogy you want to use.
Yeah.
When it comes to getting someone out of a cult, particularly the more serious ones that are more dangerous, I guess we would say, what works and what doesn't work? It seems just saying you're in a cult is not likely to be very effective.
Yeah. Yeah. So I'm not a deprogrammer or a mental health counselor. This isn't my expertise, actually, like shaking people and snapping them out of it. But yes, from talking to so many experts, what I can more easily say is what's not effective. As tempting as it is to look someone in the eye and tell them you're in a cult, you're brainwashed. Those things are not effective. That just works to alienate that person because, of course, they think that you're in a cult and you're brainwashed. Brainwashed is also really nothing but a metaphor and is a term that's often used as a thought-terminating cliche in itself sometimes, just to write off someone as hopeless and mind-controlled. So as tempting as it is to use phrases like that, they're not super effective. And also, if you're talking to like a QAnon or an anti-vaxxer or a conspiritualist, if folks are familiar with that term, the portmanteau of conspiracy theory and spirituality, if you try to, you know, unpack their logic by citing, you know, some of these more peer-reviewed studies or studies from an institution that they've been led to believe is fundamentally flawed or controlled by this evil cabal of elites,
right,
they're going to feel fundamentally misunderstood by you. So if it feels like safe and healthy for you to keep this person in your life, I would say, you know, have as much or as little of an outside influence on them as you can just by existing. Maybe use the Socratic method to poke holes in their logic via questions.
Yep.
But indeed, like, facts don't change people's minds. And so you just have to hope that they'll come to reality on their own and eventually come safely home.
In terms of the motivation or what can be appealing about being in cults or cultish groups, when we think about conspiracy theories, it seems one of the things that's often appealing to people is that the conspiracy theory is a simpler explanation that often points to more control over what happens in our lives rather than less, where, like, if there's random, unpredictable, horrible events, that can be a lot scarier than someone planned this thing. And it's just like, this is the person that did it. And we knew it was going to happen. They knew it was going to happen. It's just, that's what it is. Is there an aspect of that that applies to the attractiveness of cults?
Yeah, well, cults and conspiracy theories really go hand in hand because they create that us versus them binary, and they do a lot of simplifying of logic and of rhetoric. But absolutely, I mean, cultishness and conspiratorial belief, these things tend to spike during times of cultural turbulence and turmoil. That's what we saw in the 60s and 70s with the Vietnam War and the Civil Rights Movement, the Kennedy assassinations. People were feeling sort of existentially high and dry. And the reason why the United States, even though it's a developed country, is so religious compared to other nations that have, you know, high life expectancies and high education levels, is in part because we have so few safety nets, social safety nets that are there to catch us when we get sick or lose our jobs. We're left feeling very much all on our own in this culture. And so we end up mistrusting mainstream institutions and turning toward alternative groups for closure and answers and security. And some of those groups are relatively harmless or even positive, but there are a lot of people who are willing to step in and take advantage of people's vulnerabilities.
That's interesting. And so it seems that a lot of the same emotional circumstances and economic circumstances that we talk about in connection with so many different aspects of society point in this very same direction. It goes back to some of that underlying structure, so to speak.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, there's a reason why the United States and cultishness tend to have this pretty consistent relationship. We always have.
That's fascinating. The book is Cultish, The Language of Fanaticism. We've been speaking with author of the book, Amanda Montell, who also co-hosts the podcast Sounds Like a Cult. Amanda, really a pleasure having you on. I appreciate your time today.
Yeah, of course. Thank you so much for having me.
I want to share a story with you that really had me cracking up when I was reading it this morning. You guys may know about Fox News host Maria Bartiromo. I've talked about her before. And for me, one of the most interesting things about Maria Bartiromo, who now is just a total pro-Trump propagandist on Fox News and Fox Business, is that she used to be a really good reporter. When I was in my teens and started following the stock market and casually getting into trading stocks and whatnot, I would watch CNBC. I thought I was cool watching CNBC. And Maria Bartiromo would be on there. And she'd be reporting from the floor of the New York Stock Exchange, first woman to do so, doing really good interviews with CEOs, holding people accountable, asking tough questions. And she was really a very interesting journalist and reporter. And over the last few years, either because of something that happened mentally or because she really liked the idea of being in Trump's good graces and having direct access to a president or whatever, she became an uncontrolled, unflinching, pro-Trump, brown-nosing sycophant. And it turns out that it's not just a character that she plays on the air. There are new revelations from this upcoming Jonathan Karl book. We've told you about the book already, and there are many interesting revelations in it, that she actually spoke to Donald Trump's former Attorney General William Barr on the phone and went nuts on him about supposed voter fraud committed by Democrats to steal the election from Donald Trump. She really seems to believe this stuff. I want to read through some of the allegations outlined here. New book alleges Fox's Maria Bartiromo shouted at Bill Barr about imagined voter fraud. This is crazy. These are crazy allegations. Former Attorney General Bill Barr says Fox News host Maria Bartiromo called him up screaming about imaginary voter fraud, according to his account in a new book. Betrayal by ABC's chief Washington correspondent John Carl highlights Bartiromo's damaging role as promoter of reckless lies about the election. In the book, which comes out today, Carl writes that, quote, Bartiromo had once been a widely respected trailblazing financial journalist. Ah, here's the things I said. She was the first television reporter to report live from the floor of the New York Stock Exchange. Now she had her own show on Fox News, and she was using it to boost a series of unfounded allegations designed to overturn a presidential election. As President Donald Trump frequently praised her, granted her interviews. On Sunday, November 8, one day after Fox and all the major networks said Joe Biden was president-elect, Bartiromo used her Sunday show on the network to highlight the most outlandish allegations of election fraud through an interview with Sidney Powell. Remember Sidney Powell, that completely cuckoo for Cocoa Puffs attorney. Powell delivered a fevered rant, Carl wrote, and Bartiromo didn't express 1 ounce of skepticism. It was all a lie, he wrote, but Sidney Powell's deranged theories would have never taken hold if there weren't people in positions of power and influence who had promoted them, people like Maria Bartiromo. Bartiromo comes up several times in Betrayal. In mid-November, according to the book, Bartiromo called Barr to complain that the DOJ hadn't done anything to stop the Democrats from stealing the election. Listen to this. She called me up and she was screaming, Barr told Carl on the record. I yelled back at her, she's lost it. Can you imagine the gall of calling up the attorney general and saying, you're not doing anything to stop this voter fraud, which doesn't exist, of course. Carl said he reached out to Bartiromo for a response because, after all, it's highly inappropriate for a journalist to call the attorney general and demand he do something related to a criminal investigation. Bartiromo did not respond, but a Fox News spokesperson did get back to me and denied Barr's account of the conversation on Bartiromo's behalf. Through the Fox spokesperson, Bartiromo claimed Barr was the aggressive one, yelling and cursing during the call. Well, he'd be justified in doing so if Maria Bartiromo is calling you up and saying, what the hell are you doing? Fox reiterated the same statement in a response to a CNN business inquiry on Sunday. Later in the book, Carl described Bartiromo's program as a shortcut to Trump, saying that Powell had a reliable platform that ensured she could speak directly to the president. Powell's interviews with Bartiromo caught Trump's attention and gave her a direct line to the White House. What an insane situation that Trump White House was in those last few months. Like, it was a crazy administration throughout. But in particular, once the election took place and once it became clear that Joe Biden was going to be the next president, all the stops were pulled out. All hell broke loose. Trump having off the record meetings specifically to circumvent presidential records rules, Fox reporters calling up the attorney general and demanding that they investigate something that a reporter thinks they can tell the attorney general to do. Lawyers like Sidney Powell using the media to try to speak to Donald Trump because Donald Trump is known to watch TV all day, every day, just a complete it's almost like a childish romper room of sorts. It's hard to even know how to describe it. And of course, wrapped up in all of this are all sorts of possible potential crimes, many of which are being investigated in Georgia by the Southern District of New York, maybe at the federal level. And hopefully we'll find out even 10% of it. I continue to think that actually the further we get from the Trump presidency, the more a lot of this stuff is going to be buried and we're never really going to know the full scope of it. I want to follow up a little bit about the accused criminals who participated in rioting, destruction of property, sometimes violence against individuals. On January 6, 2021, colloquially known as the Trump riots, you know, the rioters were overwhelmingly from a political movement that claims to be about the rule of law and following the rules and doing what the law prescribes. And yet they broke the law. They broke the law by trespassing. They broke the law with vandalism and entering the Capitol building. They broke the law in some cases by attacking police officers. They broke the law in some cases by stealing things from the Capitol. Some of them also destroyed the property of media outlets outside the Capitol. They broke the law in many different ways. But once you are accused of breaking the law, they believe in due process. And of course, due process includes both sides of it. It includes due process by those prosecuting you and law enforcement. But it also includes facing the charges against you and fighting them as you are able to do and given a right to do with appropriate counsel through the judicial system. But they're not all doing that either. After allegedly breaking the law on January 6th, at least one individual has fled the country and is now desperately asking Belarus, an authoritarian state at this point in its own right, for asylum, for cover, in order to avoid facing charges here in the United States. This is an extraordinary story. A guy named Evan Newman from California has started to plead with Belarus on Belarusian state TV to let him avoid justice here in the United States. This is wild. And we're going to look at a video of this. Evan Newman is wanted in the U.S. on six criminal charges related to the attempted insurrection on January 6th, including two felonies for assaulting an officer. Now, remember, the right claims to be about support the police, law and order, due process. So guy is accused of assaulting officers. The right should be saying, oh, this guy's got to be held accountable. This guy is now trying to avoid even facing justice. Wait, that's not law and order. He was featured in the Belarusian state TV special Goodbye America. He recounted a treacherous journey through forested borderlands that landed him in Minsk and expressed his unwillingness to face justice in the U.S. Newman says he's seeking political asylum in Belarus because the U.S., in his opinion, is no longer a country of law and order. Think about that. Think about that for a second. They say they are about law and order. They then break the law and say, I'm going to flee justice because my prosecution is no longer law and order. What? This is another example of these are our principles and they are so important until they're no longer convenient for us. Check out this video. This video is from, I believe, I-24 News. And this special where Evan Newman is pleading for asylum in Belarus to avoid justice, it's obviously not in English. So this is sort of like a dubbed. It'll give you a sense of what's going on. Let's take a look.
For America's critics, the January 6th riot at the U.S. Capitol was already a propaganda coup, casting the nation as chaotic and violent. But the bizarre appearance of Evan Newman, an accused Capitol rioter from California seeking asylum in Belarus,
right,
one of the world's most authoritarian dictatorships, was more than the regime here could have hoped for.
Специальный репортаж агентства теленовостей Goodbye America. Смотрите прямо сейчас.
This is their heavily promoted news special dubbed Goodbye America on Belarusian state TV.
By the way, it's also funny how these very same law and order people who broke the law allegedly and then are fleeing justice, they also claim to be all about America, except they seem to not understand their role in furthering anti-American propaganda by showing up in Belarus and demanding asylum to avoid actually facing justice in the United States.
The U.S. is now settling scores, the anchor says, with opponents of the U.S. regime.
Playing right into it.
Newman had to flee the country or face prison and torture for simply taking part in protests, she falsely claims. We're then shown Newman himself being interviewed about how he got here, apparently by crossing the border illegally through snake-infested swamps.
By the way, they also say you got to come in legally, but he has abandoned that principle and crossed into Belarus illegally, but says it's justified because the law and order charges against him, he feels, are bogus.
And of course, why he came. He speaks English, but he's voiced over in Russian, so it's hard to hear his actual words.
They released a picture of me.
He says his photo was put on an FBI wanted list. That's true, but his next claim isn't.
What happened to other people there?
What do you think they do with people like me, he asks. They're kept in solitary confinement for 8 months at a time and beaten. Torture is a common thing, he explains to the Belarusian reporter. Torture is, of course, illegal in the United States. What is true is that Newman faces multiple criminal charges in the U.S. for his alleged role in the January 6th insurrection. Prosecutors say he taunted and screamed at police before donning a gas mask and threatening officers. According to court papers, police body camera footage showed Newman pushing a metal barricade into a police line before punching two officers with his fist.
I didn't decide to.
He doesn't even deny taking part.
And we were invited to come in, but we were there because.
All right. It's just absolutely disgusting. So listen, another one of these examples. Every principle is abandoned. Immigration must be legal. goes illegally to Belarus, law and order must be followed, commits alleged crimes, which are on video, on January 6th. We must face justice and due process and all of this different stuff, flees as a fugitive to a different country. All of these principles mean nothing to them. They mean nothing when the rubber hits the road. And this is just another example. We've got a voicemail number, 2192 David P. Here's a great voicemail, but it actually, there's something sad in it, I have to tell you. Take a listen to this.
Mr. Pacman, this is Aaron from Boise.
Yeah.
I heard your show today, and I just wanted to say that you missed your calling as a impersonator. Your Alex Jones was off the charts, my friend.
So listen, we can't find my impression. I recently did an impression of Alex Jones. I remember doing it where I was saying, you know, doing the whole that weird conspiratorial lisp, the frogs and all that stuff. We can't find it. I don't remember. Did I do it on a live stream? Did I do it in a YouTube clip? If you know where that Alex Jones impression is, we want to clip it. We think it would do well on social media. We just can't find it. So please let me know. Speaking of Alex Jones, he's been found liable for defamation in the Sandy Hook hoax case. We're going to talk about that on today's bonus show and so many other great stories. Sign up at joinpacman.com.
Are
we still taping?
Yeah, sure. Go right ahead.
We're live. We're not taping.
Oh, we're live.
No,
okay.
We're taping.
We're taping? Okay. They want me to do a little promo. And what do? I say WRCT, is that it?
WRCT Pittsburgh. Yeah.
Okay. Right. Hello and speedy delivery. This is Mr. McFeely from Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood, and I'm in Pittsburgh. I always listen to WRCT right here in Pittsburgh. Speedy delivery to you.
This is Satan. You're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM.
RCT Pittsburgh. Meaty and full of flavor since 1949.
This is Danny Glover, and you're listening to 88.3 FM WRCT Pittsburgh.
WRCT Radio 900.
Hey, this is Steve Archer.
And Donna Lynch.
From Ego Likeness, you're listening to WRCT Radio.
RCT Pittsburgh. No one is as excited about flaming cheese as we are.
Hi, this is Dean from Luna. You're listening to 88.3 FM WRCT in Pittsburgh.
You're listening in at your house. Are you listening in at your car? If you want to hear good music, you don't have to go far. 88.3 is the magic number. WRCT in the Pittsburgh area. Who say so? I say so. Who is me? Maccabi Selassie.
Those of you concerned with your health and the new USDA organic product standards, WRCT Pittsburgh would like to inform you that all our DJs are genetically modified to bring you best music.
Hi, this is Kristen Hirsch. You're listening to 88.3 FM. WRCT Pittsburgh.
We at WRCT Pittsburgh do not condone the illegal duplication of copyrighted material. But if you happen to own all the tracks we played and would like a copy of them, just FTP to FTP.
Due to a request by computing services, the remainder of this announcement cannot be.
Hi, I'm Rob.
And I'm Mary.
From High
Places.
And you're listening to WRCT
88.3 FM. A radio.
Hi, you're listening to
WRCT
Pittsburgh CMU. This is Sue Garner
and Rick Brown.
Have some barbecue sauce.
WRCT Pittsburgh, we won't respect you anymore.
It's been a long time since you've touched the hand and the heart of that special someone. You're not alone. This is WRCT Pittsburgh's Radio Automation Service. Stay tuned for more tracks from our radio and record library.
Hello, this is Adam Clayton here, the bass player from U2. You're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh 88.3 FM.
WRCT Pittsburgh. We own. Soul.
don't actually have the legal documentation to back that up.
From New York, Rock Raider.
Yeah, yeah, 1-2, Total Eclipse.
From Executioners, and we chilling on WRCT.
Word up, Pittsburgh representing 88.3 FM.
Check it out,
dial. Right? Peace.
Hey there, this is MC Honky, and you're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh.
This is Martin Atkins from Pigface, and you're listening to WRCT 88.3 FM.
Listening to WRCT Pittsburgh's Radio Automation. Please stay tuned for more incredible tracks from our extensive, vast, libidinous, and...
balls.
Awesome. I called it libidinous. It doesn't make any... I mean...
My fellow Americans, I would just like to say now, as an expert on the subject, that WRCT Pittsburgh does not blow. Thank you.
This is Democracy Now!
It is a sad day in which a member who leads a political party in the United States of America cannot bring themselves to say that issuing a depiction of murdering a member of Congress is wrong.
The House votes to censure Republican Congressmember Paul Gosar for posting an animated video on social media where he murders Congressmember Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. We'll hear AOC's speech before the vote. Then to Charlottesville, Virginia, where organizers of the deadly white supremacist Unite the Right rally are on trial. We'll talk to Slate legal analyst Dahlia Lithwick as closing arguments begin.
And all nine of the plaintiffs who were harmed are saying, we want money damages. We want to know who your funding sources are. We want to understand how these networks of hate groups work together.
Finally, the dawn of everything, a new history of humanity. We speak to the archaeologist David Wengrow about his new book with David Graeber, the pioneering anthropologist who died last year just weeks after finishing the epic work. They examine how indigenous cultures contributed greatly to what we've come to understand as so-called Western ideas of democracy and equality, but these contributions have been erased from history.
Nowadays, you constantly read people saying, well, you know, this idea of the Incas having some kind of welfare state is a projection of European categories onto them. Well, actually, it might be the other way around.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The White House said Wednesday it'll expand U.S. vaccine manufacturing to produce an additional 1 billion doses a year. Critics called the plan a good first step, but said much more needs to be done to end the current pandemic and to stop future outbreaks. Oxfam America said in a statement, quote, manufacturing should be spread around the world, especially Africa, not limited to the U.S. Fewer than 5% of people in low-income countries have received even a single dose of a vaccine. Meanwhile, White House Coronavirus Response Coordinator Jeff Zients said Wednesday about 10% of U.S. children aged 5 to 11 have gotten their first COVID shots. He announced another vaccine milestone.
And today we reached the milestone of 80% of Americans 12 and older with at least one shot.
The number of people hospitalized with COVID-19 continues to climb across the U.S., with cases rising in 36 states. Nearly 1,100 U.S. residents are dying of the disease on average every day. The House has voted to censure Republican Congressmember Paul Gosar for posting an animated video on social media in which he murders Congressmember Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and attacks President Biden. Gosar's refused to apologize and retweeted the video just minutes after the House censured him. He then deleted the post less than an hour later. Gosar is the first lawmaker to be censured in more than a decade. He was also stripped of his committee assignments. Just two Republicans voted in favor of the censure, Adam Kinzinger of Illinois and Liz Cheney of Wyoming. A man whose horned fur hat, face paint, and six-foot spear made him one of the most recognizable rioters at the deadly January 6th Capitol insurrection was sentenced to 41 months in prison Wednesday. Jacob Chansley, also known as the QAnon Shaman, had pleaded guilty to obstructing an official proceeding. Chansley was among a group that broke into the Senate chamber and left a threatening note to Vice President Mike Pence, which he penned, reading, "It's only a matter of time. Justice is coming." In Kenosha, Wisconsin, jury deliberations continue.